Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, a week of hearings and a major surprise as the North Carolina Board of Elections looks into possible election fraud in the 9th Congressional District. ICE arrests spark response from all corners of the community, including CMS. Jury selection was slow going this week in the Raekwon Boreham trial. He's accused of shooting Justin Carr during the disturbances which followed the death of Keith Lamont Scott. And the reviews are in on Charlotte's performance in the NBA All-Star Weekend. Our roundtable of reporters is ready to detail those and other stories, and we'll meet them in a moment. But the top story of the week has been the hearings into possible election fraud, and we have one of the reporters who has been covering this all week, one from WFAE, actually. Steve Harrison joins us this morning. Good morning. Welcome.
Morning, Mike.
For a week, the Elections Board has been conducting these hearings into the 9th Congressional District race. Those hearings ended yesterday, but not before a stunning announcement from Republican candidate Mark Harris.
Neither I nor any of the leadership of my campaign were aware of or condoned the improper activities that have been testified to in this hearing. Through the testimony I've listened to over the past 3 days, I believe a new election should be called. It's become clear to me that the public's confidence in the 9th District seat general election has been undermined to an extent that a new election is warranted.
Did anyone see that coming?
No, but everyone kind of realized something big was going to happen after lunch yesterday, because the last line of questioning, the state board was asking Mark Harris about these emails that he had with his son, John Harris, where John is warning him to repeatedly to not hire McRae Dowless. And Joshua Lawson, the attorney for the State Board of Elections, had asked Mark Harris, did you ever have any conversation recently with anyone saying you didn't think these emails would be part of this investigation in this hearing? Mark Harris said he didn't. He was asked again and again, and it kind of became obvious, like, they knew something. And then at that point, Mark Harris's attorney asked for a recess, and they go meet.
They, meaning the board, knew something?
I think that the election staff had not a certainty that a conversation had happened, but they had a pretty good inkling that he was up there on the stand not telling the truth at that moment. And that's when his attorney...
And some more news was made, because I was unaware of the fact that he'd been seriously ill, and he came back from that break saying that he thought, that he thought he had the stamina to go through with these hearings, but that he had been ill, and in the course of that illness, he'd had two strokes?
Right. The two strokes was, I mean, we knew he had been very sick, but the two strokes... I did not know that. And, you know, he looked noticeably different during the hearing. He'd lost a lot of weight.
Right.
I think that was kind of a missed part of the story, is how ill he was leading up to this hearing.
So he came back from that lunch break essentially having reassessed things and, I guess, spoken to his attorney, because he was saying things that conflicted with what his son John had said and what material they knew the board had at their disposal.
That's right.
He essentially said, if I'm not mistaken, correct me if I'm wrong, that he, because of his illness, was a little, his brain was a little jostled, essentially. He couldn't remember all the details and the facts. Is that true, do we think? Did they buy that excuse, or is that an excuse for going down the wrong path until his attorney stopped him?
I mean, I definitely think I can't speak to how ill he was and what condition he was when he was testifying, but I think that was, it was definitely when the testimony was going down the wrong path for him.
Right.
I think that was kind of the best way to exit this whole thing.
So when the candidate who's suing to have his election certified calls for a new election, that leaves the board few options, one would imagine. And they called what happened in these two counties, Bladen and Robeson County, a coordinated, unlawful, and substantially resourced absentee ballot scheme. This was a unanimous decision.
It was. And I talked to afterwards to one of the Republican, there's two Republican board members, and he said that he was kind of even considering voting for a new election even before Mark Harris asked that there be a do-over. So I don't know if that would have happened. But, you know, right before this, I think going into Thursday morning, the state Republican Party was still really on the offensive, saying that, you know, show me the vote, show me where the election would have been different. I think that they felt like that the hearing had gone up until the Sun testified on Wednesday. I think they felt like the hearing had gone okay. They had a chance. They were still fighting. And then it completely flipped.
I don't know if you had a chance to see the piece of tape with Dallas Woodhouse, who's the, I think, the executive director of the state Republican Party. But he was cornered by a reporter in the hallway after the hearing, and he looked devastated. I mean, he was on the verge of tears.
I did not see that tape. I mean, Dallas was there in the chamber the whole time, kind of monitoring it, spinning it, talking to reporters. And, you know, like that morning, Thursday morning, he was on WFAE and was really aggressive about his view that a new election did not need to be called. Mark Harris should still be the winner.
Mm-hmm. So what happens now? There will be a new election. Will there be a new primary, or is this just the general election?
So as of now, there's a new primary. Under the old rules, we would have just had a redo of the two candidates or the three candidates in the general election. But the legislature at the end of last year passed a law that said we will do a new primary. That I think the elections board said that'll probably be in May, mm-hmm. with a general election in October.
Which means for a whole year, the 9th District has no representative. Is there staff in Washington for constituent services?
That's a good question. I mean, I know that Tom Tillis had sent out a news release telling the people of the 9th District to contact him.
Yeah.
So,
you go ahead and talk.
Oh, I apologize.
Let's stop. Eric Spanberg is here from the Business Journal. He's just overleaping all the boundaries.
I'm sorry. I apologize. I was just going to ask, though. I think when we had the situation with former Congressman Watt, when he left, that the other members of the delegation kind of took up the slack is how they handled that in terms of constituent services.
So I'm going to bring everybody in since you've jumped over the barricades here.
I was so excited.
Glenn Berkins is here. He's editor-publisher of QCityMetro.com, and David Borax is also with us from WFAE News. So why can't the governor appoint an interim representative until next November?
I think the governor can do that in the case of a death or someone stepping down, mm-hmm. but when the board calls for a new election, then we
have a new election. Okay, so before yesterday, the biggest surprise of the week came from Mark Harris's son, John Harris, who's a U.S. attorney, by the way, and he made some very surprising statements. He came and testified essentially against his father.
He did. This was by far the most kind of, I think, even in a way more surprising than what happened yesterday.
Okay.
So to kind of recap a little bit, going back to the 2016 Republican primary, Mark Harris narrowly lost to Robert Pittenger. McCrae Dallas was working for another candidate at that time, got tons of absentee mail votes in Bladen County. John Harris is looking at this, kind of poring over the data, and calls his father that night, like, something crazy is happening in Bladen County. He thinks it's an election error. But he keeps looking into it, and he becomes more and more convinced that it was fraud. So there's these exchanges really over the next 11 months between him and his father where he's saying, like, you know, we got cheated. And then there's a point where Mark Harris is thinking about hiring McCrae Dallas for a second run.
Mm-hmm.
John Harris is repeatedly warning him, don't do this, don't do this. He uses words in emails like, we'll be on thin ice, I'm fairly certain fraud occurred. So when the Board of Elections put a massive subpoena on Mark Harris's campaign for documents, correspondence, text messages, et cetera, they did not get these emails. And John Harris is going to an interview with the investigators, and he assumes that they have them. So he shows up for his kind of routine interview and puts the pieces of paper down, like, all right, here's what we need to talk about. You know, this is really important. And the investigators have no idea. They've never seen him before. You know, their eyes get really big. You know, they can't believe what they have. And so they're kind of armed with this. They have this stuff. The Mark Harris campaign does not know they have it.
And never volunteered it.
They never volunteered it. They did not know John Harris was going to testify. The Board of Elections kind of kept John in a separate witness room downstairs for 2 days.
Now, I read that they didn't know because John has been not really talking to his parents a lot since this election happened. Is that because he knew he would be called to testify? And as a U.S. attorney, he wanted to maintain some distance and some perspective that he was not tainting all of this?
I don't know exactly what he thought. Uh-huh. He was not under any kind of gag order. He could have. He could have talked to his parents at any time.
But the younger son, I think Matthew is his name.
That's right.
Told his father that John was going to testify the night before he testified. Is that right?
I'm not sure about that. I know the way the elections board had said it to me was they were questioning Andy Yates, a Mark Harris political consultant, and they asked a question about a conversation Andy Yates had had with John Harris. And I think that really sent a lot of panic. You know, like, why are we talking about John Harris?
So this testimony is explosive because, A, the Mark Harris campaign does not know that the board has these emails that John volunteered of evidence that he had discussed this with his father. And Mark Harris had been saying all along that he had not discussed this with anyone. Here's what John Harris told the board.
I expressed my concerns based on everything that I did know up to that point, namely my belief that McRae had engaged in collecting ballots in 2016. Now, that belief was based on my review of the absentee voter data that I've already described, and also just the general sense of reports that I was getting back that, you know, this guy was kind of a shady character.
So what was the reaction to that in the room? What was Mark Harris's reaction to that, since he didn't know his son was going to testify?
At that point, he was pretty stoic. He just watching intently. It was later on at the end of John Harris's testimony when John said, like, I love my parents. I have no vendetta against them. We all need to do better. That was when Mark Harris, he began to cry. I'll say one more thing, or appeared to cry. One more thing about John Harris's testimony. He kind of went above and beyond what he needed to do. He's answering questions about these emails, but he would also volunteer his opinions. There was at one point he said, I think that they had the Red Dome Group, that's the political consultant, pay McRae Dallas to put separation between McRae and his father, which is something he doesn't know firsthand. But he volunteered it, and it was a case where, you know, he was really, I just felt like, getting a lot off his chest. And
yeah. John Harris is not just the candidate's son. As I said, he's an assistant U.S. attorney in I think, is he out of D.C.?
He's in Raleigh. Works in Raleigh.
Okay. What are the optics of his testimony, considering all of that?
I think that probably had a lot to do with it, that he felt like in his role he needed to be 100% or 110% open and above board. And I think that's probably why it was so he just didn't talk like a lawyer at all up there.
Glenn.
I think there's another optics involved that we're not talking about, and that is the fact that what was happening in that county was the worst-kept secret in North Carolina politics. You have a U.S. attorney. You have a federal prosecutor who, for all practical purposes, knew what was going on. Why had the FBI not knocked on this man's door? Why was this allowed to go on for so long? We have a member of the elections board who blew the whistle. Everyone knew what was going on, and yet it was allowed to continue. And that's the story that no one's talking about, and that is the story we need to investigate.
And that is the question: what happens next now that this has come to light? We will continue in just a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. David Borax is with us from WFAE News. Glenn Birkins, editor-publisher, Q City Metro. Eric Spanberg, managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. And joining us fresh from the board hearing in Raleigh is Steve Harrison, who has been covering the Mark Harris and the election fraud hearing in Raleigh all week. A lot of things came out of the last several days of this testimony. John Harris essentially testified against his father. father, saying that he in fact did try to warn his father of misdoings on the part of McRae Dowless, or alleged misdoings. Of course, Mark Harris yesterday's stunning announcement where he called himself for a new election. Yesterday, Mark Harris also addressed essentially why he did not listen to the warnings that John Harris, his son, gave him.
I knew John had never been down to Bladen County. I knew John had never met other people down there. And so, again, in weighing it out, I did not consider John's to be a warning that this was a problem and could be a real serious potential problem. Because I just believed he was overreacting.
He did say later on that his son John can be, quote, a little judgmental and at times arrogant.
Yeah, a taste of arrogance, I think maybe was the phrase, yeah.
Is this a case of father knows best or something else?
The attorney for the Board of Elections, he used the words Greek tragedy to describe this, how this unfolded. I think there was a case for Mark Harris that he was able, he wanted to believe that McRae Dowless was okay. And there was a path to do that. There were people in Bladen County who told him this was a great program and everything would be great. So, you know, there was he was able to ignore what his son said, and he was able to latch on to something.
He also said earlier, I think, in the conversation that he had developed kind of a pastorly relationship with McRae Dowless. He liked him. He thought he was redeemable or something.
Yeah, one thing in the hearing they talked about, a lot people talked about, was that McRae Dowless just was very needy, and he would call them on the phone all the time. And even they were too busy, and they would have to, like, because he just wanted to talk about how the race was going, politics, this, that, and constant talking.
David.
I'm not sure that Mark Harris even thought that there needed to be anything redeemed about McRae Dowless. Okay. He said when he first met him, obviously the meeting was set up by a judge down there. A lot of people came to this meeting and they vouched for him. He said at one point during the hearings that in this meeting, McRae Dowless had been so clear that he was not breaking the law that he didn't think that there was any need to follow up on this and do any more due diligence. And I think he was just not really listening to all the other voices around him.
Well, let's go back, though, to what Glenn was saying. This reputation, not just for him, but for Bladen County, is years and years old. And I think it is an entirely legitimate and logical question as to why a candidate would not only ignore his son, but ignore a son who is part of the judicial system. He's in the U.S. Attorney's office. I mean, I think that's going to be hard for a lot of people to look at and say, well, there was another path.
Well, could it be argued that the U.S. Attorney's office has been ignoring this
absolutely
for years?
Absolutely.
Well, I believe your son.
Well,
that's the point.
Yeah, exactly.
And you've got a judge recommending this guy.
Right.
This stinks.
There are so many problems in here.
One of the phrases of the week was, there are no red flags. We heard that from two or three different witnesses. And obviously, there were red flags. In fact, at one point, I think it was during the testimony of Andy Yates, the political consultant who was working for Mark Harris, they talked about the This American Life, the NPR program, that did a study, a report on the 2016 election where some of these same things happened. And they had people talking about the things they were doing that were improper. And
these flags are like the size of American flags over car dealerships. I mean, these things are huge. They unfurl and cover counties.
It's that big red flag that they fly back and forth the stage on in Les Mis at the end of Act 1.
How could you miss it?
It became clear people did not see what they did not want to see.
Well, we have a question from Chris, who emails, did John Harris report his suspicions of fraud in the primary when they arose? Not to pick on him, but as a federal prosecutor, I would expect him to do so. Did he?
He, at the time in May, let's see, the primary, 2016 primary was, I think, June 2016. He was a law clerk at the time, so he wasn't in the U.S. Attorney's office at that point. And so his suspicions, he did not. Okay. He just tried to just try to get his dad
to
stop.
You played a cut earlier this morning on a report you did on Morning Edition, Steve, with board member Jeff Carman saying essentially to Mark Harris, so you just wanted to win. Is that right? He'd said Harris has denied having heard any concerns about Mark, about McCrae Dallas. And he also said that he considered his conversations with his son to be private family conversations. Now, that doesn't negate the fact that he lied to the media, but lying to the media is not a crime. Does he face legal jeopardy for any of that?
Definitely. He told me in an interview in January, you know, I asked him very specifically about that primary and whether anyone had warned him, because the Washington Post had a very specific story that said people close to him tried to wave him off, and he said absolutely not. Telling me and the other media a different thing is that's just how it goes.
Stephen emails, throughout his testimony, Mark Harris recalled meetings and other things with great accuracy. He remembered dates and often precise times of day. It strains credulity that he couldn't remember talking to his younger son about the emails exposed by his older son just the day before.
Yeah, there was another moment, too, when Mark Harris said that he didn't kind of understand. There was some money paid to McCrae Dallas's group, Patriots for Progress, a political action committee, and Mark Harris said he didn't quite understand the rules of federal elections in terms of what they were allowed to coordinate with the campaign. And I think this was his third federal race. That seemed a little bit hard to believe. And yes, going back to the question,
well, there were also questions, though, about the testimony showed, and Steve, you were in the room, but the testimony showed on several occasions that McCrae Dallas didn't even keep records of his expenses. He just told them what they owed him, and then I think Mark Harris said, well, I thought Andy was handling that, referring to the owner of the Red Dome Group. I mean, there were just a lot of troublesome things revealed, I think, would be an understatement.
It's just how we do it down here.
And I think there was at some point there was testimony where so McCrae Dallas was going to get paid $5 per absentee ballot request form that he brought in.
Right.
But I think in Robeson County, you know, he had inflated it so much that I think maybe it came out they were paying him about $50 per form. So Dallas, I think, was really, for him, I think this was the client of a lifetime until it wasn't.
So let's talk about the man at the center of all this, McCrae Dallas. He's a political operative. He's worked for both sides of the aisle, Democrats and Republicans in the past, and he was hired by Red Dome Group, who was helping run the Mark Harris campaign. He refused to testify at this hearing unless he was granted immunity. So the board met privately and decided not to grant that immunity. And board chair Bob Cordell came out after that private meeting and asked that McCrae Dallas come to the stand and testify anyway.
We would request him to come forward like all our other witnesses have come forward and testify voluntarily. And if he refuses to do that, we have the right under our rules and our orders in this case to take
negative inferences
concerning his actions. So it's your decision, Mr. Dallas.
Mr. Dallas will only be complying with the subpoena he was given, which was to appear.
That's McCrae Dallas's attorney, Cynthia Singletary, who was asked again after the proceedings about what her client has to say.
Is there a time he'll be allowed to speak for himself?
Possibly.
Is there anything that he wants to testify on about regarding Mark Harris?
My client would love to testify under the right conditions.
What are those conditions that would be the right conditions to testify?
It would depend. I can't tell you now.
So this was not a court of law. Does it have the power of law? In other words, could he have put himself into jeopardy had he testified in front of this board?
Yes. Once he was under oath, he had to testify truthfully, which was why yesterday Mark Harris's attorneys called for the recess when Mark Harris was testifying. So it wasn't a – they weren't prosecutors. It wasn't a criminal case. But, yes, once he took the oath, he had to tell the truth.
David.
So a lot of information came out this week. There was testimony from people who worked for Dowless about things that they did that were improper. There was people recounting conversations and notes that were left at meetings and all kinds of potentially incriminating evidence. And the question now is, what happens next with this? So we know that from the Elections Board standpoint, they've scheduled a new election. That's what they were there to do. They also have the power to refer this to a prosecutor for criminal charges. And, you know, I think that's the next shoe that we're going to wait to drop on this.
Well, for example, wasn't it Wednesday night they turned over 800 pages of documents? I thought I read somewhere that a lot of documents popped up as the hearings were going on. And so there was great consternation among Elections Board members about why that had not been provided earlier.
Well, the John Harris emails, you know, that we talked about earlier, when Harris's campaign team, his attorneys realized that the state had those during the hearing, those were some of the ones they turned over.
The negative inferences that were whispered into Bob Cordell's ear a moment ago, did that go by the wayside when Mark Harris called for a new election, or would those negative inferences, did he mean by that if you don't testify, we may view that as a reason to have a new election?
Yeah, I think that was what it was, just that we'll look badly upon this decision.
The Raleigh News and Observer caught an interaction between Mark Harris and a WBTV reporter as he left the hearing yesterday in Raleigh. And in it, the reporter, and it's difficult to hear this, so I urge you to turn up your radio for a moment. He asks Harris if he intentionally lied to the people of North Carolina.
Dr. Harris, I have to ask you. Intentionally lie to people of North Carolina?
No, sir.
Why are you calling for this now?
We'll talk later. I made my statement, and we'll talk about it later.
So when he's asked, did you intentionally lie, I don't know if he could hear it or not, he says, no, sir. He looks like a beaten man in that clip, and there will be a new election. Has Harris said anything yet at all about being a candidate? And I know you reported this morning that he said nothing, but his wife said something.
She said that they're going to think about it. And I think I saw on Twitter this morning, I think that he told WBT that he's going to right now rest and try and get better and then make a decision.
If there's legal proceedings that follow this, who would be the target of those proceedings? Would it be him and his campaign? Would it be McRae Dowless? Would it be all the people around McRae Dowless that we haven't talked about, we don't need to talk about?
I think it would just be McRae Dowless and the people working for him. You know, what Mark Harris testified to and it was kind of some poor judgment and some bad decision-making, but I didn't see anything criminally that would be a problem for him.
Now, as we mentioned, John Harris, the U.S. attorney and the son of Mark Harris, said that he knew of, he believed there were shenanigans in the 2016 election, and that's why the red flags were going up for him, which is why he started talking to his father about McRae Dowless. And now, former Governor Pat McCrory, who lost to Roy Cooper in the 2016 election, wants the investigation to extend back to 2016 as well. He said that, quote, this request was totally rejected and ignored back in 2016. Evidently, his campaign asked for that investigation into these same kinds of activities. Is that request likely to be heeded, to go back and look at 2016?
I don't think they can. There's certainly nothing, obviously, they can do about the election. I think any criminal investigation into McRae Dowless would probably extend back that far. And it's worth remembering that in 2016, so in Bladen County, there were kind of two heavyweight political groups doing absentee mail ballots. McRae Dowless was working for the Republicans. The Bladen Improvement Association, a PAC, was doing this for Democrats. There was a lot of testimony in the hearing that, like, McRae detested, hated, despised the other group, and they were rivals. And Pat McCrory thought that the Bladen group, the Democratic group, had cheated him.
So put this into perspective, gentlemen. This is a pretty big deal. We have election fraud that leaves the 9th Congressional District without representation for a whole year. We have the investigation into Russian interference in the United States election 2 years ago as well. What does this tell American voters about the integrity of our election system?
Well, not only that, I would add voter suppression to that. We have so many instances of let's look at the Georgia governor's race for an obvious example. I think there is ample evidence, as to why people are so skeptical about the voting system right now.
And I think it tells us one thing that we already knew, that the real weak spot in our electoral system is not people who show up at the polls. It's the mail-in ballots. That if there is massive fraud in our system, that's the easiest place for it to happen.
But the other thing it says is there doesn't seem to be any sense of urgency within governmental bodies or individuals about fixing this. I mean, no one in Congress seems to be terribly upset by what happened in the last election, and people ignored this, and they've known about it for years in Bladen County. No one cares.
It's true. I think people are I think we want to believe that our democratic system is the best in the world and that it works the way it should. But so many different avenues here are evidence that it's not. I mean, everything from, as you say, the voter suppression to examples like this. If you haven't read this article in The New Yorker from a couple weeks ago about the Israeli firm that goes into even small towns and influences elections through social media and discrediting campaigns, at every level, our democracy is being challenged by people who have figured out the apparatus and how to tweak it to their advantage. And I think it's incumbent on all of us as voters to pay more attention about this, but we also need to look into these things and maybe bring some cases in places like Bladen County.
Steve said correctly that so far there's no indication that criminality extends beyond the actions of Dowless and perhaps some of the people who work for him. I'm not convinced of that. I think we have to wait and see what this investigation turns up.
If you're a federal prosecutor and you know that there are allegations of fraud, ongoing allegations of fraud, year after year after year in a certain part of the country, and you don't investigate, you should be held criminally
responsible. Absolutely.
From a practical standpoint, I think what happens next is prosecutors are going to look at the evidence that they have and decide where can they bring charges. And even though we may have heard about wrongdoing in some places or in 2016, it's going to come down to where do the prosecutors think that they have the best case to make.
But as bad as this is, remember, the amount of voter fraud is still minuscule. It doesn't mean this is not a problem, doesn't need to be dealt with, it needs to be vetted, all those things. But I think, I guess, if there is a silver lining, there's not a lot of evidence of voter fraud, Bladen County, to the contrary.
Well, I've said on the show before that is absolutely true, and that did not have much of an effect a decade ago. But today, when every race is tight, even a minuscule amount of fraud can turn
905 votes.
I have news for you guys. There's more news to talk about, and it has nothing to do with this. CMS guns in schools. There's an immigration rally here this week, and the Raekwon Boram jury selection has been going very slowly. We'll talk about all of that and more when we come back at Charlotte Talks. It's the Charlotte Talks Local News Roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Glenn Birkins is here from Charlotte's QCityMetro.com. He's the editor-publisher there. Eric Spanberg, managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Steve Harrison still with us from WFAE News, as is David Borax. Several weeks ago, CMS began several random searches for weapons at area high schools, but this week, a student at South Mick was caught with a gun. The gun was not discovered during a random search. Do we know how they found it? I guess not.
I'm not sure how they found it.
What, if anything, do we know about the student's intent in bringing the gun to school? Have they revealed anything at all? Because they've been playing this pretty close to the vest.
I don't think we have a lot of information about this, but there was also actually another one this week. I don't know if we have noted that one. It was at Ranson Middle School, where a student brought a gun on the bus in the morning, dropped it in a trash can on the way into school, and they had a lockdown for a while. They did a search. They found the gun. A message was sent home to parents. But so two more cases here of guns being brought to school. There's no indication in either of these cases that there was any intent to commit a crime or anything.
So does that mean that these random searches where they go into classrooms unannounced with those dogs that can sniff out gunpowder are completely a waste of time?
Well, I think that they're – I mean, that's a good but tough question. And
I mean, unless you do it every day.
Unanswerable
question. At the entrance to the school.
Well, but Mike, it's the way a lot of security works, which is yes, you're trying to catch people, but you're also trying to deter people with the thought of the random search. So I don't think you can instantly just say it's worthless, but clearly there are problems if you have two in 1 week with all of this going on.
And these searches are being done at the high school, so wouldn't have turned up something at one of the middle schools.
So also, ICE operations, which we talked about extensively yesterday on this program, took around 200 people into custody around the state, and it raised tons of concern in the immigrant community here. That was reflected in some of the students at CMS, and Superintendent Clayton Wilcox quickly said he would make resources available to help support those students, and he also had a message for them.
You're safe here with us. We care deeply and passionately about you. We care about the larger community. We care about the community that we live in. Together, we're one family here in CMS.
Comforting words. Are they enough? Do they mean anything?
Well,
because one parent of a fourth grader said there's nothing concrete. It doesn't say anything. It says they'll work with the kids, but it doesn't say when. It says they'll help the kids, but it doesn't say how.
So I think they were intended to be comforting. You know, he's made similar statements to this that you just played at the school board meetings. And, you know, he wants to put forward the image, at least, that CMS does care about what's going on with this and stands with its own students. The reactions have ranged from people who appreciate that. There was also an observer story about this that quoted a student who said that she felt reassured to know that the school system was committed to looking out for itself. But as you mentioned, there are other parents who they don't see enough here. They want
to
know.
I'm sorry.
They want to know that CMS is going to do more to protect their kids.
But we have to be clear too that there's very little CMS can do in the way. Right. This is a federal issue, and whether or not a parent is detained, picked up, detained, deported, CMS just absolutely has no voice in that. Right. And so they're kind of stuck in the middle of a very emotional and very unfortunate situation.
They're the beneficiary of the ripple effect.
Absolutely.
Of what happens when ICE goes out into the community. And there was a protest about that here on Monday.
No hate, no fear. ICE isn't welcome here, no hate, no fear. ICE isn't welcome here, no hate.
So they're chanting, no hate, no fear, ICE isn't welcomed here. That was the scene at Marshall Park. Elver Barrios, an organizer with Comunidad Colectiva, opened the rally, telling the crowd ICE is terrorizing the Latino community.
We are tired that we go to school, we go to work, and yet ICE is there. We take our kids to school and ICE wants to be there. We go anywhere and ICE wants to be there.
So how many people turned out for this protest in Marshall Park because of this increased ICE enforcement?
There were probably a couple of hundred people there. That's what our reporter from WFAE, Sarah D'Elia, reported. It wasn't anywhere near as big as a protest a couple of years ago that drew something like 15,000 people uptown. You know, the community is trying to kind of fight back here. But what's interesting to me is that there are a couple of different fights going on here. This isn't just any longer about the ICE and the federal government cracking down on illegal immigrants. There is now a fight between the federal government and local communities over enforcing the law. And the local communities have long said that they don't want to be in the position of having to enforce the law. But, you know, one of the images the other day that was posted on social media showed an ICE agent there with a jacket on that said, "Police, mm-hmm. ICE." And that confuses people in the community who don't understand the complicated structure of our law enforcement system.
Well, we had a representative of ICE, the Atlanta office, on this program yesterday, and something emerged from that because Gary McFadden, the sheriff who ended 287G, his department's participation in the program that allowed caused them to ask inmates about their immigration status, and if they were not here legally, they would turn that information over to ICE, has said on this program, Gary McFadden has said, that that doesn't mean ICE can't find out about the status of these people. They're welcome to come into the jail and ask. I mentioned that yesterday with the supervisor for ICE in Atlanta, and he said, no, we're being barred from going into the jail. So what's the truth?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. You know, in the past, it would be a question that would be asked as people were processed coming in, and then the ICE agents who actually had a little office at the jail, I toured this one time, They could go over to the computer system and bring up a list of all the people who had questionable immigration status, and they could go then and question them.
The other time I've talked with someone from the sheriff's office, they've insisted that ICE agents even now are in the jails.
Yeah. And there is, the, of course, the disagreement between local law enforcement and the federal law enforcement about the safety of the community. Local law enforcement says that 287G and these raids make the community less safe because it makes people afraid to come forward and report crimes. The federal authorities, of course, are saying it's making the community safe because we're getting criminals off the streets.
Well, and that's what I was thinking when you were talking about local communities. I mean, it's as much with local and federal law enforcement as it is anything. And so you're right, Mike. It confuses people. Who do you listen to? Who's in charge? Who's got the upper hand? You don't really know.
And of course, in many cases, the federal crime that they've committed is that they've come across the border illegally. They're rounding up these people and arresting them a lot of times on things that you or I would only be arrested for by a local a law enforcement agency, not by the federal government. Is there – what's the law say about that, that you're being arrested because your headlight's broken by a federal agent?
I mean, I think the local law enforcement has jurisdiction on that stuff, but yeah. It's the pretext under which they're stopping these folks. And as they've also said, you know, they may be targeting people who they know are here, and they will be staking them out and trying to find a situation where they can arrest them. But if there are a dozen other people there who happen to be here illegally, they're going to get swept up in this as well.
How about some good news? We've been talking in recent weeks about the accreditation woes at Bennett College in Greensboro. This is the last remaining all-girls historically black college, and it needed
one of two.
One of two. It needed to raise $5 million in order to retain its or regain its accreditation, and it exceeded that goal by $3.2 million. So they raised $8.2 million.
Actually,
right?
they raised 9.5.
Wow. Okay.
9.5 million was the final tally. Earlier this week, they appealed the decision concerning their accreditation, and they're now waiting for a decision which they expect to come next week.
Because they're going on Monday, right? They're going to Atlanta to meet with the Southern Association of Colleges and Schools Commission. A commission on colleges to...
Right. They've already gone. They've already presented their case, and I think now they're waiting for that decision.
And this is important because having accreditation is what allows you access to have federally backed student loans, and without that, their business model doesn't work.
But I think looking forward, they're saying that they're going to have to not just raise this money, but also look at their business model, try to attract more students, try to look for ways to cut. But this is really part of a much bigger decision. There are slightly more than 100 historically black colleges and universities in the country. And the question is, in this current educational environment, are all of those needed? Or is it time to talk about sensible consolidation?
Well, it took a long time this week. The prosecutors and defendant and the judge was complaining about how long it was taking to choose the jury for the Raekwon Boerum trial. He's facing first-degree murder charges in the death of Justin Carr in the aftermath of the police shooting of Keith Lamont Scott during the disturbances uptown. But they have seated 12 jurors in this trial, and they still have to pick some alternates before the trial can start. Why did it take so long to do this?
You know, they were going through one by one there were 52 people in the original jury pool, and my colleague Sarah D'Elia has been reporting on this, and I was in court one day as well. And at one point, they were sending all the prospective jurors out of the room and questioning the individual juror prospects one by one about things like, what media have you consumed about this? What do you know about this from watching the news and that sort of thing? And, you know, obviously the attorneys on both sides would like to have a jury that is friendly to them and is not biased in any way. But the judge in this case has said that he would like to have four alternates. So we've got the 12 now. He's been trying to speed this along. We have one alternate picked. There are only a handful, I guess there's only four prospective jurors left from the original pool. And I think three of those have to be picked for alternates, or else they're going to have to bring in another 20 is what they've decided. I think they're hoping to do that today, and they're hoping to start opening arguments on Monday. We'll see what happens.
And some allegations that we didn't know about have come out already in this trial, because prosecutors alleged on Monday that Raekwon Boerum was actually aiming at police when he shot and killed Justin Carr, allegedly shot and killed Justin Carr, and that, in fact, he fired twice. How do they know that?
This trial will be the first time that we see some of the video surveillance that they've gotten. And, you know, they have cameras that are around that area in front of the Omni Hotel in uptown Charlotte that captured the scene here. During those protests that night, you know, there was a huge crowd there. And it's even hard, I think, in some of these videos, the prosecutors will have to point out and circle on the video, this is Raekwon Boerum. And so they're going to have to make their case based on that. I think that's how they know what's happened. His argument is going to be that he was not doing that. He has been saying that I only did it to disperse the crowd or something like that.
So those of you laying out your Sunday night plans, the Oscars are this weekend. But last weekend was Charlotte.
Who's the host?
There isn't one. Charlotte. Charlotte will be the host of the Oscar. Because last weekend was Charlotte's time to shine. It was, of course, NBA All-Star Weekend. And the reviews are in.
You like me right now. You like me.
No. That's our eternal speech in Charlotte. It really is.
That's Sally Field at the Oscars. But Eric, could the same be said about how people felt about Charlotte during the All-Star weekend?
Well, yes. And, you know, there is a perfect connection between the NBA All-Star game in Charlotte and the Oscars, which is Spike Lee will be at both. So it's got to be the shoes. I think there were a lot of sighs of relief at how smoothly things came together. I don't know how jittery people were, but just knowing Charlotte, I think there were some nerves.
You went to every single event, I'm told.
Well, I don't know that I went to every single event, but I went to a number of them. And, you know, everything, as I say, went pretty well. There was a lot of heavy traffic around the arena, as you would expect, but in terms of security, there were no major incidents.
Right.
And, you know, going back to your Sally Field speech, a lot of people from out of town were saying, gosh, this is a clean city. People are nice. So that was what you heard over and over again. And so I think people went home happy. And the NBA commissioner said on Saturday that he was very pleased. So that made the Hornets place.
Yes, Mayor Via Lyles had a conversation with the NBA commissioner, Adam Silver.
He was so complimentary of the way we were able to move people around the city, the way that people handle all of the entertainment. He had nothing but accolades.
Don't they always say that, though? I mean, if things had been miserable, would he have said anything other than
that? Well, I don't know if the commissioner would have, but I can guarantee you the sports writers would have, because they're always grumpy. so the fact that they didn't complain a lot, I think, is probably a good sign. And the other thing, Mike, that Charlotte sells, and I think there is some legitimacy to this, is once you get uptown, you can walk to everything. And for example, last year they were in Los Angeles. That's not the case. And people did like the convenience of, okay, I'm in my hotel and I can walk to everything.
And you kind of had to walk because the blue line wouldn't stop at the arena last weekend.
Do you know something about that study with transit?
Yeah. How many people showed up? They were predicting, I think, 150,000 people. How many people showed up?
Yeah, we have not gotten a count yet. I think 150,000 was...
It was tourism folks.
Yes, it was tourism folks.
The guy with the clicker is still counting
yes,
it up.
Yes, he's still counting.
I will say this. On my GPS in my car, it shows you where there are traffic jams with little red lines on all the streets wherever there are traffic jams. And on Saturday night, I was coming back from Cornelius, and I was passing around 277, and every single downtown street was red.
Red. Yeah, I mean, there were a lot of people
actually, they
here.
Were closed.
Oh, that could be true.
They were closed.
There were a lot of people here, and like I said, I think they had a good weekend.
And I read this morning that the hotel industry, this was the biggest weekend in history in Charlotte for the hotel industry.
Yeah, and when you compare, it was right on par with the DNC in terms of the average room rates, so that's good. It depends if you use $2,012 or $2,019, but I'm turning it into a geeky business reporter. But yes, they had a really good weekend, sales way up, and so it did what it was supposed to do by most measures.
What do you mean you're turning into a geeky?
Well, I was just revealing that.
I want to talk about the massive fun party that it was. I mean, I didn't realize the degree to which the NBA All-Star Game is a cultural event, and it really hit this city hard. And there were some great moments. You know, a lot of Charlottians stayed home during this. I mean, driving to work last Friday was a dream because there was no traffic.
It was.
But, you know, we're going to remember that slam dunk that Diallo did over Shaquille O'Neal. We're going to remember Steph Curry's amazing high bounce pass for that slam dunk. It was some great basketball.
Yeah, it was.
That was an amazing moment. That high dunk pass was amazing.
They're pretty good. Those guys are pretty good.
And they were having fun. So we have 40. We have 30 seconds. So what is next? I heard rumors that we want the NFL.
NFL draft.
NFL
yeah,
draft.
I think that'll be the next thing
and
that's
that
pursued.
And that actually surprised me. How big a deal is that? It's a big deal.
Yeah.
250,000 people showed up in Philadelphia for it for 3 days.
It's shocking that people will turn out in droves to watch people sit on their phones and pick their next employees. But yes, people do that.
Do we have time to talk about the Panthers raising their ticket prices? Do we have time to talk about that?
What's the headline?
We can explore that next week. But yes, they are going up second straight year. First time under David Tepper. So welcome to the club.
What are we getting for our extra money?
Oh, Mike, you're getting a practice bubble. You're getting a more competitive team. And God knows you're probably getting a $12 beer or two.
Okay. Eric Spanberg from the Business Journal, Glenn Brookins from QCityMetro.com, and David Borax and Steve Harrison from WFAE News. Thank you all. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.